Welcome to Ordain and Establish, a podcast of the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition at Catholic University. To learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.
Well, welcome all to our CIT panel on the role of the priesthood in the evolution of Anglo-American criminal procedure. And I think we'll end up getting a little bit beyond just criminal procedure and into some substantive law and civil procedure as well. So you might call this this event, say, Priests of the Law. To you know, strikes me as a good title, which I'll get into that in a second. In any event, we'll start as we always do with our on-campus events with a prayer. In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. All right. Well, thank you all for being here. A lot of you know me, and I know a lot of you. It's good to see you all again. I'm Will Kamen. I'm an assistant professor here at Catholic Law, and the sort of managing director emeritus, I guess, or something like that, of CIT. I've been on leave this year visiting at Notre Dame, missing you all quite dearly, and so it's great to be back at Catholic Law. And it's especially great to be joined by two truly, truly august speakers, who are really, really lucky to have joining us today. So on the far side is Professor Tom McSweeney, who is professor of law at the College of William and Mary Law School. He is a graduate of William and Mary himself, where he did his undergraduate work, and then went on to Cornell, from which he holds a JD, an LLM, an MA, and a PhD. And I hope I'm not leaving out any degrees.
Yeah.
Professor McSweeney is a renowned expert in the early history of the English common law. His work is largely focused on the 13th century. He has published countless articles and book chapters, and most recently published a book, a monograph called Priests of the Law, hence my joke about that sort of being the more fitting title for this whole event. He's an elected member of the American Law Institute and the Royal Historical Society. He also sits on the board of directors of the Ames Foundation at Harvard Law School, which funds research in legal history. And then immediately to my left is my old professor, I should say my former professor, and very young professor, John Langbein, who is the Sterling Professor Emeritus of Law and Legal History at the Yale Law School. Professor Langbein holds a BA from Columbia, an LLB from Harvard, and both an LLB and a PhD from Trinity Hall, Cambridge, where he received first class honors with a U, and has since gone on to write prolifically both in legal history and in trusts and estates. I remember Professor Langbein famously saying that anything you can do with a corporation, he can do with a trust. And I think that's quite accurate.
I said you could do it with a trust.
Well, see, he's kind and modest. I think it would be true if it's that he could do it with a trust. I don't know what I could. But in any event, Professor Langbein is a uniform law commissioner under gubernatorial appointments in both Illinois and Connecticut.
He is also a fellow or member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the British Academy, the International Academy of Comparative Law, and he is admitted as a barrister at the Inner Temple, as well as to several jurisdictions here stateside. For present purposes, it most notably is the author of History of the Common Law, with our friend Rene Lerner, which is sort of the great text in that has introduced a lot of American law students to this field. First of all, please join me just in welcoming Professors Langheim and Matschmann.
Thank you.
Our topic today again is the role that the priesthood has played in the development of Anglo-American legal institutions. And I think that's a story that both of our guests might say is one that's been sort of underplayed. I think a lot of you are probably familiar with chancery being staffed by churchmen up until Thomas More, at least. But on the law side as well, there's perhaps a greater influence from the priesthood. And from Roman law and canon law than I think we have often realized or conventionally realized. So with that said, I will turn it over to Professor Langbein and then Professor McSweeney.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here. I'm going to say a word about background legal history. I think it's... students in law school often are not quite aware of the enormous influence that history and comparative law, the role they play in the or have played in the development of our thinking about. What law is and why it is. Legal history is a branch of legal studies. It's both a law school field. Witness your speakers today. It's also it's a history department field. There are different emphases there, but it is a linking field to the rest of the university, and we are in those of us who do legal history are really quite blessed to have the historians with us. The most important thing to know about legal history, I think, is its relationship to another field, which is called comparative law. They are really branches of the same subject. Legal history is basically how did we get this thing that we're all living and working to this day? And comparative law is basically the question, how come other sensible people don't do what we do when it comes to law? And history is, more than anything else, the explanation. Yes, there's some theory about why we do some things differently, but that's super added. What really explains it is because way back then, people did some things, and it took, and it continues on. There are broadly speaking, two great legal traditions that have survived and that continue to thrive. One is what we call the Roman canon, which is a reference to classical Rome and to the Roman Church. We have a wonderful slogan that comes down to us from antiquity, Ecclesia vivit lex Romanorum. The church lives Roman law. The other great tradition is the Anglo-American, and I'll get to that in a second. The church, it's very important to understand that the church developed as a Roman religion. And it developed at the time that that the Roman Empire was itself developing. It became a great commercial institution. And Roman law developed to aid it, to help it work out the problems that arise when you are a great commercial enterprise. So Roman law was overwhelmingly private law. Contract, property, succession, family law, as we would now call it, the law of persons, etc. The rest of the what we think of as the role of law, the extent of law, the Romans were not very good at. They flunked public law. Their idea of public law, as it got epitomized in the 5th century digest, 6th century, their idea was what, I quote, what pleases the prince has the force of law, close quote. If that's as far as you get in public law, you've got a long road ahead. And they were lousy at public law. And from the first century on, first century AD, succession in the Roman Empire was basically by means of a series of putches of one dictator, military guy, succeeding another in various ways. The criminal law, they were also not particularly good at, but nobody is. Criminal law is, it wrestles with issues that that even after a couple of centuries, a couple of millennia, rather, of thought and effort, it's very hard to make sense of. It's the criminal law is above all directed to preventing future crime, but that's a hard task. And the question is, how do you do it, and so forth? In the process, one of the things it's designed to do is to thwack people who actually do nasty things. Trouble with that is that we then get into this extraordinarily difficult question. Did the accused do it? And how do we know that? And then what do we do about it? What we do about it is corrections, and we've made some progress there. We no longer engage in much capital punishment. The Europeans have completely rid themselves of it, except in the pretrial process. That is when that guy who's running out of the bank, and you say stop, and he doesn't, and so on. But apart from that activity, they've largely surrendered any effort to use capital punishment, and we have too in all but a few states, and we're getting there. The history of criminal jurisdiction is fascinating. Tom's going to talk a bit about some of it. He and I have each written books about it, different dimensions. But it is a deep field. It's a kind of disappointing field. I teach trusts and estates, and that's a triumph. It actually works. You get to criminal law, and nobody really thinks that their criminal justice system works. And indeed, we are increasingly now, I think, the current wave of criminal justice thought in academia is about whether we ought to have any of it, about whether criminal sanctions make any sense, in particular imprisonment. I suspect that in your generation at the bar, we're going to wind up with much less in the way of penal sanctions, of punishment. Like, we're coming increasingly to the view, particularly with the aid of some sociological work of importance, that our assumptions about deterrence and its relationship to punishment are questionable. And so this is all being rethought, and if you have any interest in that field, this is a great time to be going into the field. The Roman law tradition in which the church developed, that tradition continues to this day. There was a movement which spread that body of knowledge and theory all over the European continent. To some extent, had to do with the fact that in some parts of Europe, the Roman law had been there when the Romans were running the shop, and it stayed there when others came along. That's the story, for example, in the southern third or so of France, so-called Pays de droit écrit, the part of the country that perpetuated its legal system continuously from the empire. There's a famous book written about, 40 years ago by a scholar from Scotland who moved here and finished up at the University of Georgia Law School, named Alan Watson. And the book is called Legal Transplants, and it makes the remarkable case that most law comes from somebody else. That is to say that most of what we do borrowed. That's the story of the spread of Roman law. The Romans were first on the block to develop sophisticated thought about law. And in all sorts of ways, continues. When you get into the Middle Ages, you get a movement known as the reception of Roman law, which is its spread basically through university study right the way across Europe. I'm not going to go through the history of Roman law, but I do think it's important to understand that there's been continuity right the way back to classical Rome. This is the period of Jesus. this body of law is growing up just at that time. And the church has had a hand in it. These two bodies of law, church law and Roman law, were by the Middle Ages taught together and studied together, and they informed each other, and they are, we still to this day speak of the Roman canon tradition. And it underlines all, underlies all of European law. With the exception of England. And just to finish up on Roman law, it gets spread. All of these European countries by the 18th and 19th century are imperialist, they are colonizers, and they spread this body of knowledge across the world. We start obviously with the Spanish and the Portuguese and their conquests of the New World. You have the later on you have the Dutch. To some extent in the Caribbean and then into Indonesia, modern Indonesia. The Germans and the Americans in the 19th century, the Americans in the Philippines and other places. Everybody wants colonies. And in the process, they bring their law. And so we've had this huge phenomenon of the transportation of these two legal traditions, the American and the English on the one hand and the Europeans on the other, around the world. The English, of course, are the great colonizers. And today, the Anglo-American tradition extends to all sorts of places that you wouldn't think of, at least in part. And they are places basically where the English planted their flag. It's a really notable phenomenon. The English law, the English legal tradition, became coterminous with the British Empire, and all sorts of people who have no idea, no interest in Henry VIII or whatever, they find themselves living under a legal system devised for somebody else. That process is now just winding down, but it was still going on vividly in the first half of the 19th century, 20th century rather. So I'm going to turn this over to Tom, what I want to say to you, I'll come back to crime. He's going to talk about crime, and I have some lots of things to say about crime. Hope you will come away from thinking about this stuff with an understanding that there were these two great legal traditions. The English, let me just say a word about the English. The English were not part of this spread of Roman law. And the reason basically is that English monarchy develops at an amazingly early period in the, it's already a central unified monarchy which covers the whole realm as opposed to the six or seven little principalities that existed immediately after the conquest. The law of early England, by which I mean, let's say, 9th century on, but certainly back to the 6th century when the invasions, for the most part, were finished, It's a Germanic customary law, which had a number of differences that turned out to be hugely important. One was that it was non-bureaucratic. The Romans governed. They needed bureaucracy to sustain the level of commerce that they had and the complexity of their what we would call administrative law, their governance of in certain areas. The English are basically they are the leftovers of a bunch of Germanic tribes who had a very different relationship to governance, as opposed to the idea that I just quoted. Prince has what pleases the prince has the force of law. That's the Roman law approach. And that takes bureaucracy to implement and govern. The Germanic tradition was quite different. It was much more collectivist. There was much less in the way of top down. They had their little warlords who became the kings, but they never succeeded in becoming Roman emperors. They were, and they had to govern with the consent of the folk in various ways. And the result was that they were spared all of the problems of organizing bureaucracies and governance and so forth. They simply called upon the folk again and again to do various things. And one of the things that they called upon the folk for was running a legal system. And above all, for doing the work of adjudication. They did not have a learned judiciary until they settled down in the 11th and 12th centuries. And so they find themselves with systems that call upon the folk to show up and inform them decide disputes. There's an endless process in Germanic law in which the ruler, the king, or whatever he was called, sends for a group of people from the vicinity where he's trying to solve something and asks them about the facts. The original impulse which results in the jury system is, I want to know what happened in order for me to carry out my job of protecting you, but I don't have much in the way of revenue. I'm not going to do this in a sensible way that we would do, which is to establish orderly patterns of governance, of bureaucracy. So I'm not going to do any of that. Instead, I'm going to impanel a group of you and ask what happened. And that turns out to have various virtues. It's a way of getting at the facts. It's which is the most important thing that any legal system is doing. Most of what a legal system does that matters is decide what happens. Once you have decided what happened, the law is almost always easy. So the Germanic approach to governance was you ask the folk for the facts, and that usually solves the problem. Suppose it doesn't. Suppose the folk say, well, we think Jones did it, but we don't really know for sure. Well, at that point, you need adjudication. You've just gone from accusation to guilt determination, and you need more safeguard, and they understood that from the get-go. And so what happens is they develop the jury system out of this this impulse to use the folk to decide. That decision in England predates the reforms that the popes were insisting on in the 11th, 12th century. And as a result, the English had developed a legal system that was of this Germanic character, that is to say, the notion that you involve the folk in both to inform you and to adjudicate. And that, Tom's going to talk a bit about how they went about adjudicating. So I may come back if we have time. If not, here's Tom.
Thanks, John. And I should say, one of the reasons why trusts and estates law works today is actually because of you. So if that's, you know, said trusts and estates works. But I was going to talk a little bit about how we get to the jury in England as a mode of adjudication. And priests' role in adjudication, both before the jury and once the jury comes into play. So probably the most obvious way in which priests participated in criminal procedure in the early common law was through judicial ordeals. Ordeals had been used in England before the Norman Conquest. They weren't unique to England either. They were a common mode of proof in many parts of Europe. And they were conceived of as a way of obtaining God's judgment. So the idea was to put the accused to some kind of test, and God will speak through that test. So in England, the ordeals of cold water and hot iron were common. So in the ordeal of cold water, they would lower you into some water that had been blessed by a priest with a rope tied around you and a knot tied in the rope. And they would see how far you sank into the water when you were initially lowered. If the knot got wet, the water had received you. If it did not, the water had not received you. And you were judged guilty. For the ordeal of hot iron, an iron would be heated on a fire. The accused would be required to hold it in his hand and carried it while he walked a certain number of paces. And then the burned hand would be bandaged, and they would unbandage it a few days later. If the wound had festered, if it had become infected, God had judged the person guilty. Now, in 1166, King Henry II, we often think of as sort of the father of the common law, instituted a new type of criminal procedure called presentment. So before 1166, serious crimes were usually brought before the king's courts through private accusation. There was a process called appeal, which was a type of private accusation of felony. Henry supplemented that with a type of public accusation, where juries from the localities were required to come before the king's justices and give them a list of people suspected of serious crimes. So this jury was called the jury of presentment, and it's the ancestor of the modern grand jury. It's an accusing jury. And the Assize of Clarendon of 1166 lays out a procedure. So 12 jurors were supposed to come from every 100. 100 is a subdivision of a county. And four jurors were supposed to come from every ville, basically a village. And they were supposed to report to the king's justices everyone who was accused of being a robber or a murderer or a thief. And if the juries of the hundreds in the ville said that you had been accused of being a robber or a murderer or a thief, then you would go to the ordeal. The Assize of Clarendon specified the ordeal of cold water. We know the ordeal of hot iron was also used, though, particularly for women. And guilt or innocence would be determined by the ordeal. So the classic way of understanding this is that the jury of presentment is like a modern grand jury. It decides whether you go to trial. And then the work of adjudicating guilt or innocence, the work a modern trial jury would do, was done by the ordeal. In reality, it was more complicated than that. The presenting jury had more of an adjudicating function. And I like to think of the ordeal less as the means of adjudication than as the accused's last chance for acquittal. And I will come back to that in a bit. Now, priests were very important to this procedure because priests blessed the implements of the ordeal. We have some surviving ordeal liturgies. There's one that probably dates to about the year 1100, for an ordeal of cold water that I often use with my students. So it begins with a mass. The priest celebrates the mass with the accused present. And you can see in that mass an attempt to put some pressure on the accused to confess. The accused is supposed to take communion during that mass. Before he does, the priest says, "I entreat you by the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit and by your Christianity which you undertook and by the only begotten Son of God and by the Holy Trinity and by the Holy Gospel and by these holy relics which are in this church and by that baptism by which the priest regenerated you, that you should not presume in any way to communicate nor to approach the altar if you have done or consented to or know who did this thing." And then as he's giving the accused the host, he's supposed to say, "May the body of our Lord Jesus Christ be a test for you today." So it's really, yeah, it's putting the pressure on, right? Don't do this if you're guilty. So the communion itself is actually kind of a test, even before you get to the cold water. And then after Mass, the priest goes out and blesses the water that the person is going to be lowered into. So the priest plays a central role in this criminal process. And it's because priests played such a central role in ordeals that we eventually get the trial jury in England. You'll often hear people say that the right to trial by jury is guaranteed by Magna Carta. It's not actually guaranteed by Magna Carta, although it was a different event that happened in 1215 that led to the jury becoming the ordinary means of trying accused felons in England, and that's the Fourth Lateran Council. So Fourth Lateran Council is an ecumenical council of the church. It's held at the Cathedral of St. John Lateran in Rome. It was an important reforming council. I like to tell my students it's one of the most significant events they've never heard of.
Right.
And Canon 18 of the Fourth Lateran Council, among other things, said clergy were forbidden to participate in ordeals. There were a lot of different criticisms of ordeals around in the early 13th century. So there were a lot of reasons why people didn't think ordeals were a great way of conducting trials. But Canon 18 seems to be most concerned with the fact that ordeals often led to judgments of blood, sentences of death or mutilation, and clerics weren't supposed to participate in those. So that seems to be the criticism that's sort of voiced in Canon 18. Now, England's in the middle of a civil war when the canons of the Fourth Lateran Council are issued. But after the war, when they're trying to get the king's courts up and running again, the king's council sees this as a problem. And in 1219, the council issues instructions to the king's justices, which say, "Since the trial by fire and water has been prohibited by the Roman Church, we have to find some other way to try felons." Right? They have to come up with something new. And these instructions that they send out to the justices are actually kind of fascinating because the council doesn't actually come up with an alternative to the ordeal at that point. They tell the justices to basically keep themselves in a holding pattern for now. They tell them to keep some people in prison until they figure out a way to try them. They tell them to allow other people to abjure the realm, leave and never come back, and to release others if they can find pledges for their good behavior. But initially, the king's council has no idea how to try people. That's how important they thought the ordeal was and how important they thought the clergy's participation in the ordeal was. Once clerical participation in the ordeal is prohibited, they assume that they can't do ordeals anymore. And once they can't do ordeals, they don't know what to do. They're not sure what to do with people who are accused of felony. The justices who receive these instructions from the council start to experiment, though. And what they finally hit on around 1220 to 1221 is the trial jury as a replacement for the ordeal. But it's actually interesting to see how uncomfortable they are with that solution. There is a case that came before the justices at Westminster in 1219. And a couple of months earlier, itinerant justices sitting in Devonshire had hanged two men on the basis of the 100 jurors' statement that they thought these men were guilty. So this was an experiment on the part of these justices. The 100 jurors said, "Yeah, we're pretty sure these people are guilty," so they hang them on that basis. And the families of the hanged men were claiming that these men were improperly convicted. The justices of the King's Central Courts held that the judgment was indeed improper, that the men could not be condemned by the speech of the jurors. We tend to think of the jury as a right. We think of it as a protection against the state. But as many criticisms as there were of trial by ordeal, and again, there were a lot of criticisms by the time you get to 1219 of trial by ordeal, at that point, people don't seem to have been quite so hot on replacing the judgment of God with the judgment of 12 neighbors, right? They were still uncomfortable with this. I think there's also a sense in which the removal of the ordeal represents a loss of the accused's final procedural safeguard, in a way that accused felons might have experienced this as a loss, right? The ordeal was in some ways your last chance. By the time you got to the ordeal, a lot of people had said they suspected you of the crime. As far as we can tell, the way presentment worked was the jurors of the hundred initially gave a list to the king's justices of everyone who had been accused in their hundred. And Roger Groot did some detailed work in the court records for this period. And he found that the hundred jurors, after they give the justices a list of the accused, would often say whether they suspected those people. So they sometimes would say, he's been accused, but we do not suspect him, right? Something like that. So the jury of presentment wasn't just an accusing jury. It wasn't confined to the kinds of things a grand jury does today. It also had a kind of adjudicatory function. It would adjudicate guilt and innocence. And it seems that in most cases where the jurors of the hundred said the accused wasn't suspected, he didn't go to the ordeal. But if the hundred jurors said he was suspected, then it seems that the court usually called the juries of the four nearest vills to ask if they suspected him. And if they said no, he still might not be sent to the ordeal. He might. There's a little bit more complexity here that I'm kind of glossing over, but it seems like they usually weren't in those kinds of cases. So by the time you got to the ordeal, the jury of the hundred and of the four nearest vills had all said they suspected you. At that point, you weren't likely to do a whole lot better with a trial jury drawn from the same locality, right? You didn't have a great shot, right, with a trial jury at that point. And in fact, we know of examples in the 13th century where the hundred jury was just used as the trial jury. So you got the same jurors who said you were suspected at the presentment phase deciding your guilt or innocence at the trial phase. So given that context, the ordeal might look pretty good to you, right, if you were accused of felony. This is probably your last chance, right? It's your chance to see what God says. My graduate advisor used to say this was your chance to take God as your witness if you had nobody else who was going to stand up for you. And your chances at the ordeal seem to have actually been pretty good. We don't have great statistics for the results of ordeals, but what we have tends to show that you had about a 50-50 shot, or maybe even a little bit better than a 50-50 shot at being acquitted once you went to the ordeal. So it had a high acquittal rate. So I tend to think that defendants weren't terribly excited about the replacement of the ordeal with the jury. My guess is that they thought of this as a loss. And the justices seem to have felt the same way. They were nervous about replacing the ordeal with the jury. So when the justices started using the jury as a means of trial, it was in theory at the option of the accused. They would give the accused the option of either being tried by a jury for good or ill now, or going back to prison until the king's council figured out what to replace the ordeal with, which, by the way, they never did, right? They never came up with the solution. So it was always option of the jury or nothing else, right? I should also say that when the trial jury took over, that didn't necessarily put an end to the priest's role in criminal procedure. So Liz Kamali published a book a couple of years ago titled Felony and the Guilty Mind in Medieval England. And there's a narrative about the medieval common law that it didn't care much about mens rea, right? Criminal intent just wasn't something the law was very concerned with. So for instance, the distinction between murder and manslaughter, which turns on one's mental state, doesn't formally enter the common law until the 16th century. But Kamali looked through the plea rolls and found some evidence that juries were actually thinking about people's mental states, right? The state of mind. And she argued that this only made sense given the context, because the 13th century was a period when people were immersed in discussions about intent. There were lots of discussions about intent, particularly in the wake of the Fourth Lateran Council. So she argued that it's hard to imagine people wouldn't have carried these ideas with them when they became jurors. And one of the mechanisms through which jurors would have learned that intent was important was confession. And this brings us back to the Fourth Lateran Council. That Fourth Lateran Council, most important event you've never heard of. Maybe you've heard of it before. I shouldn't say, but another canon of the Fourth Lateran Council required every Christian to confess their sins to a priest once a year. And confession would have been an opportunity to teach the Christian faithful what made an act culpable. And intent was a big part of that. Theologians and canonists wrote confessor's manuals, which were designed to help priests who were conducting confessions to understand what constituted a sin, what made a sin more or less serious, and things like that. I've recently been working with Raymond of Penafort's manual, written in the 1220s, for a project I've been working on. It's full of discussions of intent. I've been working in the section on homicide, and in addition to what we think of as homicide, right, so which is corporal homicide, Raymond has a whole discussion of spiritual homicide, right, which included things like wishing for a person's death, right? So jurors would have learned through confession to think that the same act might be more or less culpable depending on what the person was thinking when they committed it, and that there were some things that were intent alone, right, created sin. And Kamali argues that they took that into jury deliberations with them. And that's an indirect role that priests may have played in the criminal law even after the ordeal was abolished. One final thing I should say, since this is a panel on priests in the early history of the common law, is that a substantial percentage of justices in the courts of the common law were clerics in the 13th century. I argue in my book that I'm not sure the fact that they were clerics actually by itself, right, necessarily played a big role in how they thought about the common law. There are other things that kind of went along with being a cleric that might have made them think differently. But I will save that because I know we're running short on time. But that's a larger topic, right? What the clerical justices and the role they played in the common law.
Well, thank you both. Let's see. Before we open it up for questions, I wanted to ask you, John, in light of some of Tom's comments on the ordeals. You've mentioned that there's still sort of a great unsettledness amongst historians on sort of what to make of the ordeals, right? This question of whether, both the king's councils, but also the priests themselves who are involved in the ordeals, sort of took this seriously as a means of adjudicating guilt, or if what was really afoot was sort of other kind of sociological dynamics, right? The idea that, perhaps some kind of humiliation would sort of suffice as a sort of compromise punishment. So I was wondering if you could say a bit about the view of the ordeals at the time.
The big step that is involved with Canon 18 of the 1215 council, the big step is that the priest's role in invoking the judgment of God is abolished. The entire legitimacy of the ordeal had been that the priest, and remember, apostolic succession and all of that, the priest is, he's God's spokesperson on earth. And what he's doing is invoking God's judgment through the ordeal. Now, God is a wonderful decision maker because God cannot err. The old maxim is, to be human is to err. No such thing for God. That God had perfect knowledge. And so the challenge that was presented for the secular legal systems when the church orders the clergy to get out of this game, it's huge. We're going to move it in from divine judgment, a judge who cannot err, to the judgment of mortals. And to be mortal is to err. What do they do? Well, they're going to move to this adjudication by mortals. But the problem is, will people accept it? How do I know that judges know what they're doing, or jurors? And the answer is, we're going to develop a body of rules which will be called the law of proof. And we're going to do it in both legal systems, the Roman canon and the Germanic English. It's the same church. None of this modern business where, you know, anybody with a tent has a church. None of that stuff. And the result is that each of these legal traditions looks for safeguard. The Anglo-American tradition, the English tradition in the 13th century, is you go to the jury. And the jury is, it is thought to embody the folk. It's the voice of the people. And that seems to have legitimated this business of deciding whether or not somebody's guilty for purposes of imposing blood sanctions. The Europeans follow a different route. The Roman canon tradition is you develop rational adjudication on the merits by the evaluation of the facts. You have a court which will be staffed by a presiding judge and some other guys who are sometimes called judges, sometimes assessors or whatever, they're flunkies. These people will evaluate the facts. They will gather the facts, investigate, probe, and based on what they have learned, they will engage in rational adjudication on the merits and decide the case. And therefore, out of the Lateran Council's decision comes two quite different responses. For the Roman canon tradition, rational adjudication by people called judges who we have trained and who actually know what they're doing. And on the English side, a bunch of yokels. From all of that, over the next eight centuries or so, there's going to be a lot of refinement. We're going to come increasingly to understand how damn dangerous those yokels are. And so we're going to develop a bunch of safeguards, layer safeguards on top of jury trial. And the most important of those are burdens of proof. And especially rules of evidence designed to help the jury avoid error. That's our system, clumsy and difficult as it is. The Europeans have no law of evidence to speak of, other than burden proof. Everybody reaches beyond reasonable doubt as the standard for conviction in both systems. But the Europeans to this day do not engage in our effort to exclude relevant evidence on the basis that the jurors are too, I won't say ignorant, but too inexperienced to evaluate the evidence that we're excluding properly. So we go down this path of trying to guide and control them as we develop a judiciary, but that's a chapter which is just a little after the one that's been talked about today.
Do you have time for an audience question?
One very brief.
Yeah, so we'll take one audience question. Yes.
I don't know if this is a brief one, but I hope it can be answered briefly. So you talk about how important the trial by ordeal's legitimacy was because God cannot err, and that's what legitimized it. And so when the Lateran Council said priests could no longer take part and they had to get rid of it, and it went, the English developed a more complicated trial by jury, the only way you could replace, you know, the voice of God was if it was legitimized because it was the voice of the people. So how important do you think this development of the jury as a response was to eventual conception of ideas like popular sovereignty and consent of the governed in later English history?
That's a modest question. the answer is that the tradition of resorting to the folk for important decisions is one that is hard to cabin to whatever it is that starts it going. It's easy to transfer. And it is, therefore, it becomes a part of the assumption that this is a good way to go about deciding things. There's a large body of political theory of trying to understand how we really get to consent of the governed as our central theory of why government works and how government should work. There's a large body of scholarly work trying to understand that, and I'm not sure anybody can get beyond saying, well, you know, at some level, yes, but that's a hard game to play.
And I might add just a little bit that in the 13th century itself, kind of two things. One is there are just the barest hints of evidence that in addition to thinking about this as sort of like the people of the locality bringing their expertise to bear, right, that the jury itself might actually be a form of God's judgment, and that might have been one way of justifying the shift to the jury, the idea that you swear 12 people, religiously significant number, right, to tell the truth, the Holy Spirit might speak through that group of 12 or something along those lines. We get just little hints of that. The other thing I should say...
Let me just interrupt there. There is a phrase which is used in this trial process in which the accused, when he is arraigned, is asked, how wilt thou plead? and we would expect that to be guilty or not guilty. But they expected you to say, quote, and the clerk instructed the accused to say this if he wasn't up to speed on the subject. How wilt thou be tried? Mm-hmm. Answer, by God and my country, country being jurors. So there's a, the idea in there is that the jury embodies the whole of the people. They, the jury speaks for the folk, mm-hmm. and in this way reflects the ethics of the age, which is gets you back really to the judgment of God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing I would say is you see this particularly in the 13th century, it's just like today, in that nobody actually liked doing jury duty in the 13th century. Jurors you know, fail to show up all the time and are immersed for that and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, and that certainly in later centuries, you start to get people associating the grand jury with Magna Carta. People actually start to talk about a right to a grand jury. If I'm going to be accused, it has to be by people from my locality. In the 13th century, I think the more common view of the jury is probably like I'm being forced to do the king's work for him, and if I don't show up, I'm going to be immersed for it. That it's seen kind of as an obligation rather than as a mode of sort of popular government. But it certainly, like, you certainly see the shift in the way it's discussed in later centuries.
Thank you. Well, thank you to our speakers, and thanks for that great question, and thank all of you.
Thank you for listening to Ordain and Establish. Subscribe to our podcast, and if you'd like to learn more, visit our website at cit.catholic.edu.